a traditional Hebrew prayer for healing. Our theme for the month, our need. So, I'll tell you that I spend a lot of time reassuring myself a few times a day by looking at this chart. This is 5:38. When I get stressed out, I bring this up on my phone and I take a deep breath. It's going to be okay. Many Americans are prepared to vote for a racist, misogynist, ignorant, lazy, cheating, lying fool. Many. And that's troubling, but not a majority. Not even close to a majority. So this chart makes me happy. It reassures me that we have not all lost our minds. And I'm going to come back to this, something like this, but I also know that when I'm looking at this chart, I'm not looking at this one. Three presidential debates, one vice presidential, not a single question about climate change was asked. The most important issue facing our globe, the existential crisis of the highest order, and not a single question about what we shall do about it. This is monthly global temperature departure from average 1880 to 2016. See that big spike at the end? That's not good. It's a beautiful fall here. But every day that is warmer than normal, I think this is not good. Rising seas, growing droughts, refugees, and larger storms already happening. And action to do something about it is also happening. It's not all bad news. International action like the Paris Climate Treaty and local efforts like efforts to become more energy efficient and direct action like the protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline that Christina described. But we don't talk about the problem or about potential remedies to it. We're too distracted by the shiny object of this terrifying campaign. There's a way in which presidential campaigns suck all the oxygen out of the room. All the energy and the attention is focused on this, and we see things as yes or no, blue or red, tribal, instead of imagining larger possibilities or doing the long generational work of change. And this year is particularly bad, right? I see articles cross my feed of how to talk to your therapist about your election stress. And I hear from you about your anxiety and about your worry. I hear in particular from those whose identities and bodies are most egregiously attacked. From women, from people of color, from the disabled, from Muslims and Jews. The anxiety and the worry isn't abstract for you. It's real and deadly serious. So I want to start with that prayer for healing. Send us healing and renewal of body and spirit. Bless us with courage. I pray for healing for those whose spirits have been assaulted, been worn too thin, whose identity has been attacked and lives dismissed. A prayer for healing for our nation and for our world, so that we might have and show mercy and love. May it be so. Of course, it is those whose lives are most on the line who are working the hardest to make sure their voice is heard and their vote is counted. Thus has it ever been. This is not Susan B. Anthony, the Unitarian suffragette trying to vote. There's a meme going around online that this is Susan B. Anthony. It isn't. She was arrested for attempting to vote in 1872. But this is actually Ernestine Mills, an English woman trying to vote in 1910. It's her husband in the top hat who's trying to help protect her from the policeman. He's kicking her face. I watched the movie Suffragette about women like Ernestine Mills this weekend. And the lack of the right to vote was really just emblematic of all the ways in which women were and are in some places and sometimes second class, working conditions and lack of parental rights and abuse and violence, all part of a piece. If you want to talk about vote rigging, let's talk about centuries of not letting women or people of color or people who didn't own property vote. Having the vote is the mechanism to challenge other oppressions. And it's why disenfranchisement is essential to all other systems of subjugation. This isn't just in our history, it's in our present day. North Carolina severely restricted the opportunity to vote early as part of an overall scheme, part of which were struck down by the court, but part of which were not, to reduce the influence of minority voters. It was its intent and result. So this is a couple days ago, people wind up to vote. As someone said, when you have to wait 4 hours in line to vote, that's a kind of poll tax. So consider this your pastoral instruction: vote. If you haven't already done so, do so. It is your religious duty as Unitarian Universalists. As an advocate for democracy, to vote. Voting is your duty. So is using your conscience to decide how to vote, and I trust you all know how to do that without me spelling it out any more than I already have. There's a line that the IRS sets, and I'm right up against it, but that's all right. I haven't stepped over. I know exactly where it is. Use your conscience. And in 16 days, this election will be over. Can I get an amen? Amen. But 16 days can seem like an eternity. So here are three quick tips on how to survive the next 16 days. First, breathe. Breathing is important. Anxiety manifests itself in shortness of breath. So pay attention to your body. If you're watching the news, well, stop. Don't do that. Don't. Read the paper, it's better for you. Whether you do it online or in hard copy, reading is better than watching. It's less stressful. If you're feeling tense, take a walk. Read something else. Play with your children. Kiss your lover. Play Pokemon Go. Play cards. Make art. Do something different. Remember that life is more than this. Second, check your sources. Share and read only things you can verify. On social media, sites like Occupy Democrats and the other 98% are fake about 1/5 of the time. So don't share those. My go-to is 538, where that lovely chart lives, and in this particular election season, the Washington Post, which has done excellent work. Be informed. Fear is a virus. Don't be contagious. Remember, it is in the interest of media empires to get you hooked. And fear hooks like nothing else. Everything is breaking news. It isn't always breaking news. One of the ways that a carnival barker has risen to be the nominee of a major party is because our media, desperate for eyeballs and advertisers, treats what is serious with disdain and treats what is ridiculous with credulity. Don't play that game. Third, do something useful. Sharing a post on Facebook doesn't count, I'm sorry. Go knock on doors in Beloit or Dubuque, make calls to Arizona, contact the campaign of your choice and give them an hour of your time. Breathe. Check your sources, do something useful. But in 16 days, it'll be over. Then what? That's frankly the harder question. How do we heal our politics? How do we respond when racism and ethno-nationalism have so clearly been revealed and authorized as legitimate? How do we respond when violence and threats of violence are common, when the basic principles of democracy are at stake? The wound is bared open for all to see. Now we can try to heal it. In my first sermon this month on healing, I said that healing is first an act of seeing, of noticing. And so we must notice what is wrong in our body politic. When some people who would be helped by the economic policies of one party support the other for no discernible reason other than racial tribalism, when some white evangelicals are willing to vote for an admitted adulterer who expresses total ignorance about their faith, when one campaign amplifies the tropes and frames of white supremacy, then there is no other conclusion than this: a refusal to surrender white supremacy is core to a large portion of white Americans. This is not a surprise to those of us paying attention. But if we are to heal our politics, we must take this seriously and head on. We must name it. We must not avoid it and later wish it away down the memory hole like some bad dream. If this is the central challenge, the predominance of ethno-nationalism and racism as the plurality force in one of our two major political parties, how do we respond? It's not my place to give a policy response or even a political response. I am, thank God, not a pundit. It is my place to give you a theological response. A spiritual response. How do we respond as a religious people, as liberally religious people, to the force and power of racism, sexism, ableism, and xenophobia in our civic life? I believe that we respond with our core principle, which is the core principle of all religions in their heart, to love one another fiercely. And to see one another as kin unto us, as family, the stranger as our neighbor. Love your enemy. See unto each other's eyes and notice each other's spirit. See their Buddha nature, their inner flowing power. Know that we are all stardust, cousins, all one family tree. This is the core calling of our faith. The oneness of creation and of humanity, the universality of dignity. The spirit of love and kinship calls us to the most important and difficult spiritual work, empathy. To take the lives of other people seriously, to see them as real people, with real lives and hopes and dreams and hearts and fears and meaning. Real people. Sexism does not see women as people. It sees women as objects, evaluated for their worth by their looks, their compliance, how they make men feel. Racism does not see people of color as people. It sees them as less than human, useful for their labor perhaps, and good to the extent they comply with the norms and patterns of whiteness. Ableism sees people with disabilities as less than fully human. Xenophobia does the same to the stranger, as if national borders determine whether or not a person is worthy of respect. Other country skies have sunlight and clover too. Go through the list. Each form of discrimination and oppression sees people as more or less human, more or less important, based on their proximity to an idealized, imagined state. In our country, rich, white, male, straight, not disabled, Christian, but only a little bit, middle-aged. Attempts to restrict the right to vote and concerns about the vote being rigged really come down to this: people who are not like me might get a say about how things are run. All these isms are interconnected, as we have seen so clearly. Sexism, racism, ableism all go together in one piece of normal versus abnormal thinking. And the great crisis of our time, that chart I showed you before of climate change, that's connected too. For it is, by and large, the world's poor, mostly people browner than I am, who will pay the cost, while it is the rich, and mostly folks white as I am, who have reaped the rewards from all the carbon we have burned. to address climate change means living in a different way, in a different relationship to the world and all who live in it. All this requires living in a different way to the people we share the world with. So when people say that our nation is changing, this is what they mean, that normal is slipping. And they define normal in a very particular way. That people who have been excluded are starting to be included. That the idolatrous notion that worth is correlated to sex and ethnicity and so forth is starting to fade away. So if you have a notion that only some people are blessed and others are cursed, the righteous and the damned, if you believe that, even subconsciously, and now you see that maybe you're not automatically in the blessed category, well, that's terrifying. That's my picture of what's going on. Does it sound right to you? If it does, and it does to me, then what we need right now is lowercase u universalism. We need to say that everyone is worthy of respect and dignity. We need to say that including more people in the circle of love doesn't mean you have to leave. You can stay, but you can't close the door behind you. Let freedom ring from every mountaintop to every soul. We need to cultivate deep, real empathy, not pity, but respect, curiosity, care, and moral imagination. We need to say that other people's experiences are just as valid as our experiences. We need to check our assumptions against the facts and admit that we might be wrong about things sometimes. A healthy skepticism of our own beliefs, a curiosity about other people's lives, these are essential virtues in the liberal religious life and in the civic life, and much in need today. That's what terrifies about the nominee and many of his supporters, a lack of humility, a lack of respect for the facts and care for the lives of others. All these things go together. When we are empathetic, we are receptive, open. We don't think we are the only person on earth. We care about the lives of others, whether they appear to be like us or not, without expecting them to be like us. We like to learn about the world, about each other, because knowledge is larger than what we already think we know. So where do we go from here? We must proclaim and cultivate and practice a wider spirit of love and empathetic understanding. To be curious and caring, to value each and every life. We must first and foremost practice that ourselves. Long before we start telling other people how to live, we had better walk the talk. We must practice cultural competence, feminist, inclusive, anti-racism, wide open, humble living. We teach by our example more than by our words. And we will show others, children and adults and the world, the glories of the open and loving life by living it. We must be the one who stands up, or the two or the three or the six who stand together. But we must do it because of our deeper love for each and every person. If we succumb to our own mirror tribalism, if we don't check our sources, then we're not practicing what we preach. That doesn't mean pretending there is no racism or sexism in the world. It doesn't mean holding those who hold those beliefs to account and those who spread it to account. But it does mean loving those caught up in racism and sexism, including ourselves, to a better way of being human, to turn them into sevens. We must live our values, sing our love, embody our hope. The work of transformation is patient, long, and dedicated work. We do it in how we raise the next generation to have a wider view than we have. And that is good news, for they do have a wider view. To heal, we must first see and name what is wrong, without judgment, but with clarity. And then we must live in a way that heals. Feast on a diet of love instead of hate. Exercise the muscles of empathy instead of exclusion. Pray for understanding rather than vanquishment. Build an always more inclusive world than we have known. And be filled with a knowledge that we are one people. And let shine through our living this truth, we are one human family. Everyone counts. Let this truth shine through our living so brightly that we illuminate even the most dismal hour. May we be carriers and amplifiers of the spirit of love. Breathe. Check your sources. Be useful. And do it all with an open heart and an open mind. For the next 2 weeks and all the weeks to come, an open heart and an open mind. Together with others, with time and love, all things are possible. I invite you to rise in body or spirit. We'll sing together, "We Are a Gentle, Angry People."